Welcome to the Science Update Podcast. I'm Bob Hirshon, and this is the podcast for June 19th, 2009. This week, we'll tell you how researchers are using the bedbugs' own alarm pheromones in the war against them. We'll meet a scientist who says that the complexity of bird songs depends on the climate. And we'll tell you why the realities of forensic voice comparison are very different from what you see on TV. To start us off, Suzanne Bard found out how the messages contained in prairie dog alarm calls are expanding the frontiers of animal communication research.
The calls of Gunnison's prairie dogs may sound like chatter to you, but animal behaviorist Khan Slobachikov of Northern Arizona University says the burrowing rodents are sophisticated communicators. He and his colleagues have discovered that the prairie dogs produce unique alarm calls for each different type of predator.
They're able to describe who the predator is in terms of whether it's a coyote or a hawk or a dog or a human. And they're also able to describe the individual features of an individual predator, such as the coat color and size and shape of a domestic dog or the color of clothes and size and shape of a human. Because apparently the different predators, the different individuals, hunt in different ways. So, for example, some coyotes will hunt prairie dogs by walking through the colony and paying attention to where the prairie dogs are. And then if they see one prairie dog slightly away from its burrow, they'll charge at that prairie dog and hope that the prairie dog runs away from its burrow rather than inside the burrow. Other coyote individuals will check out to see where there's a concentration of prairie dogs and then go lie down next to a burrow with this concentration of prairie dogs and wait there for up to an hour. And if a prairie dog emerges from the burrow, then the coyote leaps and grabs the prairie dog and kills it and eats it. So there are individual differences in hunting style, and presumably these individual differences have contributed to the development of this sophisticated language-like system that the prairie dogs have.
Slobachikov and his team also tested the prairie dogs with predators they'd never seen before, like a great horned owl, and the prairie dogs coined new alarm calls for them which hadn't been documented before. He and his team don't yet know for sure if the animals learn the calls or if they're innate, but their observations suggest that they're probably learned.
We've observed when the pups first come up into the world, they essentially babble like little kids. They produce calls just like babbles. And gradually over time, the calls become more and more refined so that they start looking like coyote calls or dog calls. And just last year, we've observed what looks like a school where an adult will stand there and produce a call, and then there might be 10 or 12 pups. Some of them are the adults. Some of them belong to other individual prairie dogs. And the pups then start babbling to try to reproduce the call.
He and his colleagues have returned to the field this year to try to document this phenomenon. If they're right, it'll be the first evidence of an animal school ever observed in nature. He says prairie dog populations have been reduced by 99% in the past 100 years, but says the misunderstood animals deserve a little bit more respect.
Really, what this shows is that they are much more complicated and sophisticated than we've given them credit for. And that they essentially hold out a key that might tell us that other animal species are much more complicated and much more sophisticated than we've given them credit for as well. That there's a lot more complexity in the animal world than we've ever suspected.
Slobachikov's written a new book called Prairie Dogs, Communication and Community in an Animal Society.
Thanks, Suzanne. Well, now we'll turn to alarms given off by some real pests and how researchers are using them to their advantage. Ohio State University grad student Josh Benoit gets a lot of attention at parties when he tells people that he studies pheromones in the bedroom, until he admits they're produced by bedbugs.
It doesn't really work well for picking up girls.
But he says that being a social pariah is a small price to pay when it comes to fighting the bedbug scourge, which has gotten worse over the past 15 years. Benoit says many bedbug populations have become resistant to conventional pesticides.
What happens is you'll spray once, but you won't kill all the population at one given time. And so a couple of them survive, you'll end up with a reinfestation right then. And then the problem persists.
In addition to evolving resistance to pesticides, he says bedbugs travel more than they used to. people are more mobile and the bedbugs simply hitch rides. Modern tourism has helped the bugs spread to even the most posh hotels.
You carry one or two of them in your bag with you, you can end up starting a new infestation. They're so persistent because they're resistant to a lot of stress, so they can survive for long periods. So you can bring a bed bug into a hotel room, it can bite you once, then you can survive almost up to a year or more sometimes.
While bed bugs probably don't spread disease, they do feed throughout the night, and people can develop large welts and bad allergic reactions to them, not to mention suffering a chronic loss of sleep. Sometimes the only answer is to destroy all the cloth-covered furniture, couches, mattresses, you name it. But that's not very practical for most people. So Benoit and his colleagues are trying to beat the bedbugs at their own game. They recently found that they could cause a mass bedbug exodus within seconds by applying the insect's own alarm pheromones to an infested area.
They have immediate response to these, usually less than a minute. They'll become agitated and then they'll disperse at that point.
The bedbugs were forced to run through an area surrounded by desiccant dust, causing them to dry up and die.
And so if you can use the alarm pheromone at once and help drive them out, then hopefully all of the bedbugs at once will be exposed to levels that are toxic.
Andy says the bedbugs are less likely to develop resistance to this tactic than to traditional pesticides. The treatment appears to be effective, but he cautions that the alarm pheromones need to be tested on a larger scale to make sure the insects don't just disperse to a new home. Next, human music varies in complexity, from Twinkle Twinkle Little Star to cacophonous postmodern symphonies, and the same is true of bird songs. Reporter Justin Warner tells us one reason some bird songs are more intricate than others.
Some bird songs, like that of the scaly-breasted thrasher, are simple and repetitive. You could barely call it a tune. But others, like that of its cousin, the brown thrasher, are far more complicated. Now, new research suggests that a bird's native climate can determine its musical chops. Behavioral ecologist Carlos Botero of the National Evolutionary Synthesis Center in Durham, North Carolina, led the study. It compared different species of mockingbirds.
We found that species living in more variable and unpredictable environments in terms of climate tend to also have more elaborate song displays.
As to why, he offers two possible explanations. One, that female birds in unstable climates may be especially interested in mates who can learn and adapt easily, so they use the complexity of a male's song to size up his learning skills. Or perhaps harsher environments simply force females to be more choosy about mates in general. Despite the advantages of a virtuoso song repertoire, Botero says there is a downside.
For example, just devoting the neural tissue that is required to maintain and to produce those songs is something that is very costly.
What's more, he notes that birds spend valuable time learning songs during their formative years, time that, in some cases, could be better spent developing other skills. So it makes sense that birds would take their musical arms race only as far as the climate requires. Thanks to our friends at the Macaulay Library of Cornell University for the bird recordings.
Thanks, Justin. Well, humans and birds may be the champions when it comes to producing beautiful songs, but there's a new composer in town. This music was composed by a computer program designed by scientists at the University of Granada in Spain. Computer scientist Miguel Molina says their artificial intelligence system can crank out infinitely long, spontaneous compositions that suit particular moods.
We have different melodic patterns, different rhythms, different instrument combination for every kind of emotion.
He says the program could make background music cheaper for businesses like department stores by eliminating the need for licensing fees. But he also thinks the program could be used by human composers, inspiring them with new ideas when they're suffering from writer's block. Finally, Suzanne reports on an attempt to make the use of voice recordings in criminal trials more reliable.
On CSI or other popular crime shows, when a forensic scientist is given two voice recordings to compare, they display two waveform pictures on a computer screen, line them up with each other, and shout, "It's a match!" But according to scientist Jeffrey Stuart Morrison of the Australian National University, the reality of forensic voice comparison is unlike what you see on TV, and much more complex. In a court trial, the prosecution might assert that two voice recordings, one gathered as evidence while a crime was being committed and another that was made of the defendant, were indeed produced by the same person. On the other hand, the defense might claim that the speakers were two different people, and that could help exonerate the defendant. When a forensic scientist is brought in as an expert witness during such a trial, he or she must make a statement about the strength of the evidence with respect to these two assertions. And making such a statement is challenging when it comes to the human voice. A speaker never says the same thing the same way twice, and forensic scientists like Morrison are trying to identify which acoustic properties of the human voice are reliably consistent within a single speaker, but very different between speakers. He studies the changes in the acoustic properties that occur while vowels are being spoken.
Feel the difference in the shape of your mouth when you say the vowel a and when you say the vowel e. The different shapes give different resonance frequencies, which is what makes the vowel sound different. When you say the vowel I, the shape of your mouth changes and therefore the resonance frequencies change while you're saying the vowel. Previous research has found that what matters for vowel identification are the initial and final resonance values and not the details of the trajectory between them. Therefore, each speaker has the freedom to choose the trajectories which best suit the peculiarities of the shape of their mouth. This means that there may be big differences between speakers and small differences within speakers.
He says the big differences between speakers and small differences within speakers could make this method of vowel analysis a more reliable way of comparing forensic voice recordings. That could help the judge and jury to determine whether a voice recording was or was not produced by a defendant.
Thanks, Suzanne. That's our show for this week. Next week, could arsenic in water make some people sicker from swine flu? Also, we'll tell you why food poisoning may have prompted exploration and settlement of the South Pacific by Polynesians. And we'll talk to a scientist who says narcolepsy is an autoimmune disease. Until then, stay up to date on the world of science by listening to the Science Update Podcast Daily Edition. We've got a new story every day, Monday through Friday. You can find it on our website, scienceupdate.com, or at iTunes. And if you're stumped by a science question, give us a call at 1-800-WHY-IS-IT. If we use your question, you'll win a Science Update mug. Thanks for listening. I'm Bob Hirshon for AAAS, the Science Society.